Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Ron Reagan. He's written a memoir called My Father at 100. Welcome to the program, Ron.
Thank you, Vic. Appreciate being here.
Wow, Ron, this book was 100 years in the making, wasn't it?
Yes, and yet still somehow I only had 6 months to write it. I wish I'd thought of the idea a year and a half ago as opposed to just a little less than a year ago now, but that's the way it goes.
Well, clearly you put it out to mark the occasion of your father Ronald Reagan's 100th birthday on February 6, 2011.
Yes, indeed.
And with so many books that have been written about your dad, it must have been quite a challenge to come up with something that hadn't been written about, but fortunately, you had your memories and all kinds of anecdotes that nobody else could share.
That's true. I mean, it was a bit of a daunting prospect, and I had not been eager to do something like this really ever before. Everybody in the family, it seems, has written at least one book about my father, but I hadn't really been drawn to it. I certainly didn't want to do it while he was in office because that would seem kind of unfair and exploitive. But the 100-year thing did get me. I was talking to my mother on the occasion of his 99th birthday, and she, of course, brought up the 100th that would be the next year, and I was politely voicing excitement about that, but inside I was thinking, oh, God, not another aircraft carrier. Please don't make me go to the opening of a bridge or something like that. But then I started thinking about it, and I thought, oh, God, 100 years, that is a long time. That is a real span of history, and the world must have been a very different place back there 100 years ago. And I was searching for his inner character, and I thought it must have had its genesis back then, and in that very different world, that very different America, and so that's where I went looking.
And you go back to the little towns in Illinois where your dad grew up, and there were several of them, and you really spent a lot of time in the book in these early places, and you go back to the things that formed your dad, and one thing that seems really important was he was passionate about football.
Oh God, yes, he was obsessed with football. This, I think, speaks to the kind of inner core that he had, which is what harbored his ambition, his more naked ambition. He didn't think that was a particularly worthy quality, and so he kept it under wraps. He was a modest sort of guy, in that respect, but he thought that he could get real attention for himself on the football field. And as a youth, his boyhood hero was a young man named Garland Wagoner, who lived in Dixon, Illinois, and was a local football star, and then went to Eureka College and starred in the football team there. And my father was determined to follow in his footsteps. Of course, he had a couple of drawbacks. He was terribly nearsighted and not particularly fast. So that meant that he was going to play on the line. Unfortunately, he wasn't a very big guy, and so he spent a lot of time being battered about by much larger people before he finally cracked the first string there. But that was his obsession. He just, he loved the game of football and loved the roar of the crowd, as it were, even if the crowd was really just a couple of rows of bleachers at Eureka.
And he had his own Eureka moment, and he really went to that college for one primary reason, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, you could say maybe one and a half reasons or two reasons. His girlfriend, almost fiance at the time, Margaret Cleaver, they called her Muggs Cleaver, she went there. And so he kind of followed her there. But his primary goal once he got there was to be on the football team. And his grades indicate that. He wasn't a terribly good student in college. He'd been an excellent student in grade school and a pretty darn good student in high school. But once he got to college, I think he had other interests.
Ron Reagan joins us. He's written a memoir called My Father at 100. He didn't have the body for football, and he wasn't fast on the gridiron. But when you got him in the water, he was fast, and he had the body, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He was a natural swimmer. Absolutely. One of the surprises to me was to discover that what we now call freestyle swimming, or they used to call the Australian crawl, was actually only fully developed in his lifetime. So essentially, when he was in college, he was employing a stroke that had really only come to into its own 15 years or so before. 1912 was actually the first time Duke Kahanamoku, won an Olympic medal swimming a freestyle stroke that we would recognize today. So this was a kind of a new thing then.
And these are a couple of sports, swimming and football, that kind of defined what you think was your dad's personality. And that was sort of a form of heroism, because as a swimmer, he became a lifeguard, and he ended up saving 77 people who were drowning in the river.
Yes, by the time he was 22 years old, he'd saved 77 lives, starting when he was 15. That's a bit of a confidence builder, I would think. But I think those summers on the Rock River there as the lifeguard at Lowell Park were a real formative experience for him. It's the perfect job for him. He said it was the best job he'd ever had at one point. And it allowed him to be, at one and the same time, a figure who people focused on, the hero, the man of the hour, but also solitary. Because as a lifeguard, of course, you have to be at a remove from everybody else. You can't be running around and, you know, hanging out at the hot dog stand. You have to be watching. You have to be paying attention all the time. And he certainly did that.
You go back and you look at some of the historical record and the anecdotes about your dad that have been repeated before, and there's a couple of them that you look at closely and you come up with some new conclusions. And one of those is the story when he supposedly came home and found his dad kind of passed out on the porch.
Yes, which I have no doubt happened. His father Jack would occasionally go on a little bender, and this wintry evening, he was returning from the local Y, or maybe the library, and he snow was on the ground. And as he approached their home on Hennepin Avenue there, he noticed a sort of a bundle at the dark bundle at the doorstep. And when he approached further, he realized that it was his father, passed out drunk on the doorstep. Now, at this point, the story, I think, veers into the editing room, essentially. My father's version of this is that he first feels like he just wants to step over his father and, you know, just leave him there because he doesn't want to deal with his drunkenness. But then he has a kind of coming-of-age moment, realizes that he needs to kind of man up and take responsibility. So in his version of it, he grabs his father's, you know, coat collar, drags him over the doorstep, and then somehow muscles him up a narrow kind of angled staircase to the upper floor. I've now been in the house and seen that staircase, and puts him to bed, and then, you know, goes downstairs and doesn't tell his mother when she comes home to spare her feelings. Well, when I looked at that staircase and I thought about him as a little boy, he was undersized at the time, and Jack was a pretty burly fellow, and I thought to myself, I don't think he dragged anybody anywhere, and he sure didn't drag him up those stairs. And I thought, well, you know, what probably happened is that he did grab hold of his coat lapels or something and start shaking him, and Jack probably woke up. Hmm. Jack probably had some pretty pithy and perhaps profane things to say when he did stumble to his feet. But my father edited that out of the story, I think, because it would have unfocused the story. This was a story of his coming of age, and it needed to have a certain form there. And if Jack had too many lines, it would have been a distraction. Hmm. So Jack becomes something of a stock character there, as opposed to the real individual he was. And this is something I think my father, you know, did occasionally with stories from his childhood.
Another example might be when he went back to Dixon, and he was with the football team from Eureka College, and there were some black players on the team, and they wouldn't let them stay at the hotel.
Right. They pull into the hotel, and he goes in with the coach, Mac McKenzie, to check into the hotel, and the fellow at the desk says, sure, we can accommodate the team, except the two black players. Now, the coach says to him, fine, we'll stay in another hotel. No hotel in town is going to take the black players. Fine, says the coach, we'll sleep on the bus then. At this point, my father intervenes. He said, wait a minute, you know, and he's thinking, I'm sure he's terribly embarrassed, by the way, he's in his hometown, and how he couldn't have realized that this is how the check-in was gonna pan out, I don't know. But he must have been embarrassed, and he was looking for a way to kind of make it all right for everybody, to not have the team stay on the bus. And he says, look, you know, to the coach, you know, the two players are two friends. The black guys are going to be really, you know, embarrassed if they feel like they're the cause of us having to sit, you know, spend the night shivering on the bus. Tell you what, get a cab. I'll get in the cab with them, and we'll go to my folks' house. They do live just close by, and we can stay there. My folks aren't going to have any problem, you know, with the black, you know, these black kids staying in their house. Now, you know, I mean, that's fine, but in his telling to me of the story when I was growing up, he omits the fact that this was Dixon. It becomes a kind of anonymous town. And I asked him once, I said, where was it that you could just drive to your folks' house? Oh, well, they just lived close by, he says. But I think it presented him with a real conundrum, a rock and a hard place. Mm-hmm. He talks about racism in one of his autobiographies as being tumors in America. Well, that would make Dixon one of those tumors, one of those aberrant diseases, you know, disease pockets in America. And that would be a very uncomfortable thing for him to admit about Dixon. But the alternative is that America itself is systemically racist in that period, and Dixon is just, you know, typical of the time. And that makes America at that time less the golden, huge, shining city on a hill that he would like to imagine than it really was. So he's got nowhere to go there. He kind of paints himself into a corner.
Ron Reagan joins us. He's written a memoir called My Father at 100. His father, Ronald Reagan, would have been 100 years old on February 6, 2011. You have so many fun stories in this book, and I was just tickled by a number of them. And I love the one where he and his buddy are playing with a shotgun.
Yes, that's right. His friend Monkey. His nickname was Monkey, and because he was curious, apparently. And one of the things he was curious about was his dad's shotgun, his pump-action shotgun. So there they are upstairs, and their parents are downstairs, you know, playing bridge or whatever they're doing. And Monkey gets the shotgun out of his parents' closet, and he puts it on the floor and pulls the trigger, and nothing happens. My dad takes it then, pumps it, points the gun at the ceiling, thank goodness, and pulls the trigger and blows a hole in their ceiling. And the parents come rushing up the stairs, of course, fearing the worst, and find the two little boys sitting on the bed reading the Sunday school review as if nothing has happened in this cloud of plaster dust that's coming falling from the ceiling, the shotgun laying there.
That's what I like about these stories, because they kind of show an aspect, different aspects of your dad's personality.
Yes, indeed. There's, of course, his stubbornness. Tell a story about him. He and I went out to find some very heavy rocks once to build a patio at his ranch in Santa Barbara. He wanted to build a patio for his bride, for my mother, and wanted it to be of native stone. So we take the Jeep and the trailer, and we head out, and we get some rocks, and we load a ton of these rocks into the trailer, and now we've got to head back to the ranch house. Well, there's a low road and there's a high road. I'm thinking we'll take the low road. We've got a ton of rocks behind us in a trailer. And Dad wants to take the high road because it's shorter. So we head up this ridge with precipices dropping off on either side of us, and the rocks have a different idea. And eventually we're heading back down the ridge backwards with the rocks leading the way. And we finally skid to a stop at the bottom of this hill, and I'm thinking, well, okay, now we're taking the low road because, you know, that was crazy. But oh no, he's not going to let a little thing like gravity defeat him. Four times we tried to get up that ridge before we finally crested the top of it, grinding the gears and stomping on the gas the whole way. And three of those times, of course, we kept getting dragged back down backwards, but he wasn't giving up. We were going to go, and finally we did. We made it, and we built the patio.
I love that story. Did he ever get flustered when you were trying to go up there two, three, four times?
Oh, you could see that he was just determined, and his jaw was clenched, and he was, you know, we'd back up a little farther every time to get more of a run at it, and he was pretty fierce about it, but I was ready to jump ship at a couple of times there. I mean, my God, you're being hauled backwards down this ridge by a runaway trailer full of rocks, and I was thinking, we're going to die here, but he was determined and, you know, just crazily kind of calm through the whole thing. But and I thought, well, we're in it together now. I can't bail out. I gotta stick with this. And we finally managed it, of course.
Another story that you tell, which I really enjoyed, was back in the 60s. I'm guessing you were a teenager, and your dad was, I think he was probably the governor of California, because he had California Highway Patrolmen guarding him. And you had a thing that you would do where you would pretend that you were taking punches at your dad.
Yes, when I was a kid and all, I would sort of, you know, fake box him for a time. I overheard him saying to my mother once, I can't wait till he gets over this kind of Oedipal phase, this competitive thing. You know, it was all good-natured, of course, but the poor man, I was probably just battering him after a while. But yes, I would do that.
Until you ran into Shemp.
that I ran into Shemp, yes, not his real name, of course, but this was a highway patrolman who was one of the drivers for my father, and I came out one day in front of the house. He was waiting for my dad to come out, and I went up to him. I'd known him since I was a little boy, and I was now kind of a young teenager, and I sort of, you know, faked like I was boxing him, just sort of mock, and he grabbed my wrist and twisted it back and put me on the ground. He's a big guy. Mm-hmm. Put me on the ground, and I mean, it hurt. I thought he was going to break my wrist, and when he finally let me up, he just looked at me, absolutely no humor, and there was no friendliness there at all. He said, never raise your hands to a man unless you intend to use them, and I thought, ooh. But I didn't say anything to anybody. I just, you know, in that day, you know, that was between me and Shemp, basically. And if I wasn't going to get any satisfaction from him, so, you know, I just leave it alone, let it go.
But you stopped throwing punches at your dad, didn't you?
No, actually,
no.
I didn't.
Okay.
No, that didn't change. Oh. I just figured Shemp was a little psychotic.
Okay.
I certainly didn't throw any punches at him anymore.
All right.
But no, I was still, you know, my dad had and I had a very comfortable sort of physical relationship. Mm. And so, you know, we were always kind of wrestling around and arm wrestling and swimming and, you know, doing all that kind of stuff together. So.
Yet he was very competitive, wasn't he? Like when you would swim and you would race, he would always win, wouldn't he?
He would, and he explained it to me. It wasn't that he was so competitive with me, but he said to me one time, you know, I'm not going to let you win. That didn't mean that he'd rub my nose in it and beat me badly when I was a little kid. You know, he'd slow down and let me catch up and then, you know, just beat me at the end of a swimming race. But he said, if I let you win, you know, one day you are going to beat me. But I want you to know that when you do that, that it's a real victory. I want you to have confidence in that. And I don't want you to be wondering about whether I just let you win instead. So there came a day, of course, a little earlier than I think either one of us suspected would, when I was about 12 years old, summer of my 12th year, and I did beat him up and down the pool by employing a flip turn, which he didn't know. That wasn't something anybody did in his day, uh-huh. Swimming. And that enabled him to make it a win-win situation for both of us. I think it was a bit of a letdown to him that his 12-year-old son had beaten him up and down the pool. But then he thought about it a little, and at dinner that night he said to me, "Say, did you do one of those flip turns?" And I said, "Yeah." "Ah, well, that's why you won. Until then, we were even." And I said, "Yes, until then, we were even."
Hmm. Ron Reagan joins us. His memoir is My Father at 100. You have a couple of anecdotes in here that almost verge on the surreal, and you don't have a whole lot in here from the middle. Let's say the famous story about your dad creating Chicago Cubs baseball games from a ticker tape of the WHO studios in Des Moines. You don't have a whole lot of stories about him being governor of California or even being president. But
no.
There are...
I really wanted to look at his early life, and that was going to be the focus of the book. And then, of course, I jump ahead to the end to kind of give it closure. But I didn't deal too much with Hollywood and the governorship. I didn't want to make it a political biography at all. So I knew at no time was I going to really, you know, take that on in any detail. That's not for me to do. That's for other people.
Well, I think that was great myself, because the stuff that you did include is really interesting. And one of the surreal stories is when you're in the Philippines and that wave hits your dad.
Yes. We'd been out swimming. There was a hurricane offshore in the Philippines. He'd been sent by President Nixon on one of these kind of tours, and I'd gone along with him. He thought this was a way for me to see the world a little bit. And so we flew in Air Force 2 over to the Philippines, among other places, and they took us out to this island, to a little resort for a kind of day at the beach. But there was a hurricane offshore, and the surf was kind of rough and pounding, shore break there, and we'd gone in swimming and all. And at one point, he was coming out of the water and walking up this rather steep coral sand beach, and a very powerful wave broke and shot this layer of water up the beach that caught him at the heels just as he was taking a step and knocked him right on his behind. And I immediately rushed to his aid. And there's, you know, I've seen home movies of me, you know, grabbing his arm and digging my heels in and trying to pull him to his feet, before another wave breaks. And I chicken out and I dash off, of course. But at least he was on his feet by that time. And he told my mother that he was very proud that I'd come to rescue him. I was a little put off that he wouldn't tell me that himself, of course, but I thought I was kind of staking my claim there with him. And it was, you know, if it was something to do with the physical world or anything, I thought that that was my my bailiwick, as it were.
Well, you have a completely unique perspective that nobody else has. And another really great story was, I think it was in Iceland, and you went there as a reporter, and your dad was there as president negotiating with the Soviets. And
it was actually Geneva, Switzerland.
Was it Geneva?
The first summit with Gorbachev. Yeah.
Okay, and Gorbachev is giving you the evil eye.
See, well, I was the only one within miles, I'm sure, who was wearing a red flannel shirt and blue jeans. Everybody else was in a suit. So when they came into the Hofti house where they, no, not, that was Reykjavik, the Chateau Fleur in Geneva, he, you know, they were doing a little photo op and all with the press there. And so they were sitting side by side, and I was in his eye line. And I suddenly realized that Gorbachev is staring at me. And so I stared back at him. And before I knew it, we're in a staring contest. You know, flash bulbs are popping, and Sam Donaldson and people are yelling questions and stuff, and Gorbachev's staring at me. I think he's wondering, who the hell is this guy in jeans? But I'm thinking, you know, I'm not losing this staring contest. It's like, you know, this is the Soviet Union and all. I can't, you know, I can't bail out here. I have to defend the country by outstaring him. Of course, I had a tremendous advantage, which is that I wasn't on display in front of a bunch of press people. And he eventually, of course, had to turn his attention elsewhere.
Yeah.
But it was a strange moment. I thought, you know, geez, does he have nothing better to do than to stare at me?
Ron Reagan joins us. He's written a memoir called My Father at 100. His dad, Ronald Reagan, would have been 100 years old on February 6, 2011. And I try to live in a vacuum. It's hard. I know that our listeners don't live in a vacuum, and they've probably noticed all the press and media about this book and about you.
I imagine they have.
And I guess I owe it to the listeners to at least ask you what you think about all that.
Well, I realized when I was going to end the book with the end of his life, and of course Alzheimer's was the disease that killed him, that I would have to face Alzheimer's itself squarely, and that the question of whether he was afflicted with the disease when he was in office would inevitably come up, no matter what I wrote about it. I would be asked questions about it. So I tried to deal with it as forthrightly and as honestly as I could, given my experience. And the conclusion that I arrive at is really a deduction based on what we know about Alzheimer's now and when he was finally diagnosed, which was in the early to mid-90s. What we know about the disease now is that it is a process that unfolds for years, even decades, before identifiable symptoms arise. And given that, it's a pretty obvious deduction that the disease must have been present during his presidency. Now, that is very different from saying that he suffered from dementia during his presidency, and I think that's the thing that confuses some people. They hear Alzheimer's and they think dementia. Dementia is a symptom of Alzheimer's that usually arrives in the later stages, and I say specifically in the book that I did not see dementia-like symptoms in him.
And you've had a long career as a journalist, as a member of the media, a broadcaster, a very diverse career. You've written for a lot of publications. When you're out there in the media and you're seeing your dad's name and your dad's words being thrown around by people, it seems like more all the time. When someone like the former governor of Alaska wraps herself in the cloak of your dad's reputation, what's your reaction?
Well, I think it's kind of unseemly. I understand why Republicans do this. They don't have any other icons really to rely on. The previous Republican president, George W. Bush, is not somebody they're going to hang their hat on. And, you know, from there you go back to, what, Nixon? You know, I don't think that's going to do them any good either. Eisenhower, well, he was a fine guy, but there's that whole military-industrial complex thing, and that makes him a little complex, too. Mm-hmm. So Ronald Reagan is the obvious choice for a Republican politician to wrap around themselves. Now, having said that, I have to admit that he and Sarah Palin have virtually nothing in common. Mm. My father, you know, for years before he ever ran for office or achieved office, was studying politics, studying policy, all that sort of thing. He wrote his own speeches when he was governor of California, wrote his own radio addresses. He had given a lot of thought. By the time he became president, he had been involved in policy debates and political thought for decades. That is really not the case with Sarah Palin.
The first time I think I became aware of your dad, we're about the same age. I think the first time I noticed him was probably watching TV as a kid. And didn't he introduce a show called Death Valley Days?
Death Valley Days, absolutely.
I remember that. I think that's the first time I noticed him.
Yeah, sponsored by Baraxo Soap.
That's
it. A lot of Baraxo in the house for a while.
The 40 Mule Team.
Yes, that's right.
Well, this is really a good book. I really enjoyed it.
Well, I'm glad. I hope a lot of people enjoy it. I'd be disappointed if some of the people who are perhaps prone to listen to some of the chatter that has been going around over the last couple of days get the impression that the book is really all about Alzheimer's. It's not. That's a relatively small part of the book. And I think, ironically, that many of those people, many of them conservatives, would very much enjoy the book. I think they would see a very heartfelt and altogether warm portrait of somebody that they feel a lot of affection for.
Our guest is Ron Reagan. His memoir is My Father at 100. It's come out at the 100th birthday of his father, Ronald Reagan, February 6th, 2011. In retrospect, looking back, I'm sure your book was probably longer before the editors got a hold of it. Is there anything that you wished you had put in there that you didn't, or that was taken out that you're glad was taken out?
Not anything I think that I wished I'd put in, and not much was taken out, actually. It was a very light edit, a very deft edit, but a very light one. A terrific editor at Viking named Rick Cott. I did, most of the stuff that was taken out was at Rick's suggestion, and he was absolutely right. I didn't want to get into politics in the book, but at the very end, I weakened a little bit. And when I got into just mentioning the fact that a lot of people like to speak for my father and attribute ideas to him and all of that kind of thing, I thought that I would mention one thing that I thought that I knew absolutely for a fact, based on my knowledge of his character, that he would not have agreed on. About in the last 10 years or so, and that is the torture issue. That it was so beyond the pale, would have been so beyond the pale for him that he simply couldn't have tolerated something like that.